We're now in 1 Nicholson Street, which is a very iconic place for the city of Melbourne.
1950s.
That's the right decade. 1955 to 58, yeah, to be
completed
precise.
Completed in 58, this
and
one.
And this is the Imperial Chemical Industries House, also known as ICI House, today known as Orica House. A building that is very important for many different reasons. So we'll try to summarize them, but we could speak for a very long time about this.
So this was designed by Batesmart McCutcheon. We're looking at some of Melbourne's best architects, really, one after another. These were very influential. It's probably Melbourne's oldest architectural firm that is still in existence. It was a very radical building at the time. It was completed in 1958. And it was the very first office building in Melbourne that exceeded the city height limit. There was a kind of a blanket, you will not go no higher than X, I don't even...
132 feet. Which was, in effect, it was one third more than the width of the primary streets of the city, which were 99 feet. So you add another third of that, and you get 132, which translates to 40 meters, which is still in place today as a urban design sort of...
That's where our podium comes.
Correct.
From.
Correct. The podium idea that was sort of prescribed to some extent in the 80s and still carries on as an idea today.
So this is 19 stories, which is very radical and actually interesting for a couple of reasons. A high-rise building sitting outside the HODL grid, so it doesn't sit on the grid of the city. It's not part of the CBD. It kind of hovers on the edge of it. It was also the tallest building in Australia when it was built. And the other very interesting negotiation that allowed it to go higher was this idea of, if we go higher, we'll give you a courtyard. So there was a trade-off done. And Giorgio, you know more about the kind of planning trade-off, but I might come in and talk a bit about maybe the unintended consequences of doing something like that.
Well, the rules of the day, which were the Uniform Building Regulations, had a clause that allowed potentially to break the rules, believe it or not. I think it was phrased for the improvement of the course of business. That was the clause. And so in essence, you had a regulatory system that was prescriptive, and yet there was a clause that allowed you to take an exception that could be approved by the relevant authorities. And the architects were very able to exploit that clause to the maximum. And in effect, what they did, by doing that, they also anticipated and showed to the city how you could provide high-rise building, which were built rather than on a prescriptive basis, they were built on the idea of the plot ratio, or FAR, a floor area ratio, meaning that once you know the area of a site, you could zone it, you could give it a number that you can use to multiply the area in order to obtain the actual net lettable area. And so in doing so, the tower is taller, but for the same amount of area, you gain on the ground space some free public areas.
So I always see this building as a moment of urban change in Melbourne, where a trade-off language and a culture of trade-off between developers, clients, the city, designers, all started to take place about, well, I'll give you this if you give me this. And it's something that still continues
that's
today.
Right.
The buttons have got stronger and stronger and the push is harder and harder. I guess what I think is a danger attached to some of these things is when a trade-off has been done and we end up with a beautiful courtyard, an urban courtyard like this, what's the danger of somebody later on coming in and saying, oh, there's an empty block of land. I want to put another building on that land when the trade-off has already been done. So somewhere embedded in the deal needs to be, you've got your contra for the deal, if you can call it contra. That's our agreement. That doesn't mean you've now got another site that you can actually develop.
That's right. So this is very much the genesis also of that culture of project-based regulations rather than
negotiations.
Negotiations, yes.
Yeah. Now, this is very celebrated as one of the first skyscrapers in Australia and as an exemplar of the ideas of modern architecture that were brought here from the US. So this is the first time we start to see what was happening in America starting to happen here. Very, very proudly.
Yes. And there are two source buildings, I think, you can see in this building. One is the appearance of the Lever House in New York, primarily due to the fact that the glass is very similar, the sort of blue-tinted glass, which was very characteristic over the years. In effect, however, the plan of the building is very similar, and it borrows from an example in Chicago, the Inland Steel, which I understand the architect, McCutcheon, saw on the drafting table of SOM in the early 50s. So there was also a direct knowledge transfer of architects that used to travel to the US and bring back this knowledge in Melbourne projects.
Yeah, and this almost represents the moment that Melbourne started to get this vision of being an American city rather than being following those Beaux-Arts tradition that we saw in Alkestan House. That's where we were. And by the 50s, we were saying, no, let's go high. Let's build high-rise. Let's go up. Let's be a contemporary steel and glass city.
Skyscraper city.
Yeah.
Yes, that's it. And of course, other Australian cities did that too, but this building symbolises that transition in Melbourne, but I would argue also probably Australia-wide to some extent, because as you mentioned, it was the tallest in Australia, but it was also one of the buildings to incorporate not only the built form of the tall tower, but also the technologies of the tall tower, the curtain wall, the all-glass appearance, but appearance only in part, because in reality the building has a meter-tall spandrels behind to protect from fire spread, for example. And it was also a building that, despite all this technological innovation, was marred by an event that was quite unfortunate, where some glass panels on the western facade facing towards the city started to fall without any apparent explanation.
I think it's probably called the Australian sun facing west.
Yeah, well, it was...
I don't know.
Was the sun a combination of a fault in the glass, which is not so much a defect of production, but is an inherent characteristic of toughened glass that develops these impurities that can cause a spontaneous breakage of glass. Now, what's interesting, this was one of the first buildings, if not the first building in the world, that was subject to these failures. And rather than blaming each other at that time, the client and the architect decided to engage CSIRO and try to find out what the cause was. And the CSIRO investigated, and they were able to realize that toughened glass, there's these impurities that can happen in any toughened glass, for that matter, that can cause the glass to explode without any apparent reason. But the reason in reality is an impurity within the chemistry of glass that once toughened can cause the glass to explode without any warning. And so it's interesting, this building was one of the first in the world that introduced this knowledge about the risk of so-called spontaneous breakage in glass.
How interesting.
Yeah. And fun enough, 60 years later, we've had instances in Melbourne of balconies and balustrades exploding. Well, they're exploding for the same exact reason for which they exploded here in 1960. Except that we forgot about the lesson learning of this particular building.
Nice to hear it was a lesson to be learned rather than ending up as a court case.
Yes, that's right. And what staggers me is also the attitude of the industry at that time to try to understand the problem rather than blaming each other. Another good lesson learned from this wonderful building we have here in Melbourne.